Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothie McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Connor, and welcome to this week's episode of Intelligence Squared. Today, we're featuring another debate from our friends at Intelligence Squared Germany. And in partnership with the European Council on Foreign Relations, they staged a debate on the motion, Joe Biden won't fix the transatlantic relationship. It's a fascinating and very timely discussion, as Biden announced a number of members of his cabinet this week. And it featured Matt Carniching, chief Europe editor at Politico, going up against Suda David Wilp, deputy director of the German Marshall Fund. And the debate was chaired by Jana Pularin, senior policy fellow and head of the Berlin office at the European Council on Foreign Relations. We hope you enjoy it, and now let's go to the episode.
Hello and welcome. My name is Jana Pularin, and I'm the head of ECFR's Berlin office. It's my great pleasure to welcome you today to a first. This is our first ECFR and Intelligence Squared online event. We've done a couple of events together, but this is our first in the virtual world. So I'm very happy to introduce, first of all, the motion of today's debate. So the motion is Joe Biden won't fix the transatlantic relationship. And looking at recent political op-eds or La Grand Continent interviews or today's keynote speeches, I think this can be considered a very timely topic. I want to introduce my first speaker, and my first speaker is the fabulous Matt Carniching, who speaks for the motion. Matt is Politico's chief Europe correspondent, and he's based in Berlin, and I think that many here consider him kind of the sharpest tongue in town. So he joined Politico in 2015 from Wall Street Journal, where he spent 15 years. And he is an interesting mix. He's the son of an Austrian father and an American mother and grew up in Arizona. So he's an Austrian-Arizonian. He was named a Pulitzer finalist for national reporting in 2009 and led a team that was named a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in international reporting in 2011. And Matt, you have the floor for exactly 6 minutes. And if you go over time, I'll brutally interrupt you. Shoot.
Thank you, Jana. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in today. It's quite an interesting topic, a very timely topic. President Trump was right, almost right. Europe really is the enemy. Not America's enemy, as Trump often said, but its own enemy, its own worst enemy, you might say. That's why I support this motion, because Joe Biden can't fix the transatlantic relationship. Only the Europeans can. The trouble is, they refuse to. Over the past several years, Trump's open hostility towards Europe has allowed the Europeans to hide behind his own antics and their own indecision about what to do on issues like defense, trade, and so on. Really the foundational aspects of the transatlantic relationship. Trump, with his attacks, basically created a diversion where Europe didn't really have to decide on issues that have been percolating in the background for quite some time. But to consider the current situation, you don't need to look at ancient history. You just need to look at the past couple of weeks. And earlier this month, and Jana already mentioned it, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, whose name I will henceforth refer to as AKK in order to avoid that tongue twister, she published an op-ed in my own publication, Politico, in which she offered what I would consider something of a reality check to both the Germans and the Europeans concerning the transatlantic relationship. And her message was that even if it wanted to at this stage, Europe could not sever its reliance on the United States for its security. And I quote, "Illusions of European strategic autonomy must come to an end. Europeans will not be able to replace America's role as a security provider." It didn't take long for Emmanuel Macron to respond to this. And as I'm sure everybody knows, he has formed his own sort of philosophy around the transatlantic cooperation, which he has dubbed strategic autonomy for Europe, which many people obviously disagree with. And he responded by saying in his typically concise manner in a 12,000-word interview that he profoundly disagrees with what Kramp-Karrenbauer, AKK, had written in Politico and said in a previous speech and called it a historic misinterpretation. Earlier today, then, AKK gave another speech doubling down on what she had said and at the same time claiming that she and Macron were, in fact, in agreement with one another, that there wasn't really any light between them, as everybody was saying. So if you're confused about this, you're not the only ones. The point is that there is complete disagreement in Europe about what to do on the transatlantic front. And France and Germany, I remind you, are the two countries who are supposed to be closest, the so-called motor of Europe. And if they can't agree on these issues, it's hard to see how they're going to pull the rest of the continent behind them and come to some form of new paradigm with the Biden administration or any other administration. I would also argue that if everyone in Europe agrees, as AKK and Macron are saying, that more needs to be done on defense in particular, then why not just do it? There's a recent comment from the former Italian Prime Minister Enrico Letta that made me chuckle. "We can't allow Europe to be depending on some thousand voters in Nevada, Arizona, or Pennsylvania," he said. And given that I was born in Arizona, I felt specifically singled out by that, but I agree with him. The problem is that Europe itself refuses to do anything about it. Over the summer, as you know, the European Union passed its latest 7-year budget. Originally, for defense initiatives, there was a proposal from the European Commission to spend just over $17 billion on the European Defense Fund and some other initiatives for the next 7 years. And what they approved was $7 billion. So here you can see just the gulf between the rhetoric and the reality, and which is why I think it is so difficult to understand why anyone could think that it will depend on Joe Biden to figure out what Europe wants to do on the transatlantic front. So again, if you're asking what Biden can do, as we have with this motion, the answer is nothing. Another recent example of this dissonance in the European discussion is what's going on right now between Brussels and Poland and Hungary. And while this is not a transatlantic issue per se, I think it's instructive to see that if Europe can't even agree on fundamental questions such as what is the rule of law, then how is it going to come to any form of unity on the question of the essence of the transatlantic relationship going forward? The conventional...
I think I need to interrupt you here. because your 6 minutes are over, and we are very strict.
You're very strict.
But you can come.
Okay.
You can
come back,
back
to other points afterwards.
Other points were in the question section, but now I want Suda to put on her boxing gloves and step into the ring. Suda David Wolp is the deputy director of the Berlin office of the German Marshall Fund, where she has been for, I think, now almost a decade. She was previously director at international programs at the U.S. Association of Former Members of Congress in Washington, and she has studied at Johns Hopkins and Columbia. And she's a dear colleague. And Suda, the floor is now yours for another 6 minutes and counting.
Thank you, Jana. Thank you, Intelligence Squared and ECFR, for giving me the opportunity to be the cheerleader for the transatlantic relationship. I'm in good company with German Defense Minister AKK. It's a thankless job these days because, as Matt mentioned, the transatlantic relationship is not perfect. And there are it's full of conflicts even within Europe. But nonetheless, I do think that Joe Biden can fix the transatlantic relationship from its current broken state. And so I am against the motion. I believe that Joe Biden will fix the transatlantic relationship for three reasons. One, because of who he is. Two, because the timing is right to fix the transatlantic relationship. And three, because of just out of pure necessity, Joe Biden needs the transatlantic relationship in order to reach his immediate goals. So point one. Why? Well, Joe Biden has personal convictions and a strong background in U.S. foreign policy. He's a traditionalist, and he believes the transatlantic relationship is an anchor for the rules-based international order, a system largely created and maintained by the United States that served our interests quite well over the past decades. It's not perfect. It needs reform, but it has definitely given Europe and the United States relative stability and prosperity. Joe Biden also values our alliance system. He sees the advantages of it, and he has said that he is going to reach out to European leaders to quickly regain their trust and assure them that America is back and is a dependable partner and will work within the multilateral framework. He's already vowed to rejoin the Paris Climate Accord, and he's also said he's going to renew membership in the WHO, all music to the ears of Europeans. And he definitely thinks the transatlantic relationship is a force multiplier. Joe Biden also has a strong interest in Europe. Even before he became vice president, he was either chair or ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee since 1997. He saw Europe up close. He saw Europe at its best when it came to European integration. And he also saw Europe at its worst and still takes a special interest in the Balkans today. Second point. Joe Biden will fix the transatlantic relationship because he has momentum behind him. Why, you may ask? Well, the last 4 years have seen transatlanticists basically staring into the abyss. For the first time, we had a U.S. president call the European Union a foe, and for the first time, a U.S. president looked to pull the rug out of under NATO. I think there is definitely a desire on both sides of the Atlantic to kiss and make up and to mend fences, but regardless of intellectual debates about European sovereignty or strategic autonomy. Merkel acknowledges much last week during her press conference. She said that Germany needs to step up and take greater responsibility. And Matt will probably say, you know, Suda, we've heard that several times. And he is right. But she also added that, you know, she can understand why the United States expects it and that Germany's working on it because she realizes, along with other European leaders, that talk is cheap and it's time to deliver and Europe must share the security burden with the United States. And in fact, Germany has actually increased defense spending by 40%. Back in Washington, Joe Biden also has bipartisan support. Democrats and Republicans will continue to exert pressure on Europe when it comes to relations with Russia and China. But I think that most Democrats and Republicans would agree, hard to believe that there is something to agree on, but they think that the transatlantic relationship has been through the ringer over the past 4 years. And last year, they passed the NATO Support Act in the House of Representatives just to show solidarity with Europe. Popular opinion is also on Joe Biden's side. According to the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, 62% of Americans would like to work with other countries in order to solve global issues. And according to Transatlantic Trends, a majority of Democrats and Republicans want the United States to remain involved in European security. And just last week, Deutschlandtrend, I don't know if you guys saw this last week, said that 80% of Germans think that Joe Biden will revive the transatlantic relationship. My last point, Joe Biden will fix the transatlantic relationship because it's in his interest. A strong transatlantic relationship will help him tackle his immediate goals. One, the economic recovery. He needs a transatlantic relationship to kickstart the economy. Europe and the United States together make up nearly half of global GDP. And also in terms of containing the coronavirus, Joe Biden needs strong transatlantic cooperation once we start opening up borders. And we can take the role model of COVID cooperation between pharma and BioNTech as an example. And there will be other frontiers for scientific cooperation, whether it's artificial intelligence or climate change. And I, for one, would rather have standards being set in the transatlantic space rather than elsewhere. Finally, Joe Biden has also called for a summit of democracies where he'd like to bring a network of democracies together in order to strengthen the democratic system, to strengthen our way of life. And he'll definitely need European participation for that. And he also needs to also have Europe stand with him against external revisionist forces that are looking to attack democracy.
Before I have to interrupt you here, your 6 minutes are over. Okay. We're out of time.
Oh, I didn't get the math points. Well, we'll get to that later then.
Okay. So, but to warm you up and our audience up, my first question to both of you, first to Matt and then to Suda. The question is, in Germany, we have an upcoming election too next year. It's the end of an era. Kind of Merkel, if all things go according to plan, will really step down. And do you think that this will have any effect on the transatlantic relationship? Matt, first over to you.
I think it'll have huge effect on the transatlantic relationship. I just don't think that we understand what effect it will have right now. I don't think even Emmanuel Macron apparently understands what effect that will have. I thought it was interesting in his comments this week that he said, well, I don't agree with AKK on the strategic autonomy question, but I happen to know that Merkel agrees with me. Whether or not that's true is a separate question, but I thought his reference to Merkel was quite interesting because she's going to be gone in less than a year, and there are serious questions, I think, about the influence that she will continue to have. It might be more likely if Armin Laschet replaces her, which is a big question mark, that you would see some continuity on a lot of these questions. If Friedrich Merz becomes the head of the CDU and the next chancellor, or if you were to have a SPD chancellor under Olaf Scholz, you would be dealing with a completely different set of circumstances. So I think nobody really knows.
Suda.
Yeah, I mean, I think it will definitely play a role. There's precedent. Somehow America pops up into election campaigning in Germany. We saw that with Schroeder's reelection campaign, on the eve of the Iraq war. And it will certainly come up. But the thing is, all the chancellor candidates that Matt ticked off are mainstream politicians and believe in a strong transatlantic relationship. So once there is a chancellor, and even if it's somebody from the Green Party, I think that they will all come around and look to a traditional role between Europe and the United States. Tradition is not, I mean, we're not going to go back to the way it once was, but they'll look to have a strong relationship with the United States.
Thank you. So after this first warm-up round, I think I present you the kind of result of our poll. This is not the final one. This is kind of what we got before you even started talking. So we had the motion, Joe Biden won't fix the transatlantic relationship. We had 35% of our participants agreeing with the motion, but 51% of our participants disagreeing with the motion, and 14% who say that they don't know. Just that you know kind of what you're up to and that you kind of that you need to change this if you want to win this debate. So let's go right back to the debate here. And this time I start with Suda. So there was one question in the chat. Winston David Kippen actually mentioned the fact that Obama actually chastised Europe for underspending and free riding, and kind of the Europeans did not come along. That time they were unmoved. So I would interpret that speaks kind of against the fact that kind of this time the Europeans will kind of hear the bells ringing and come around. What do you argue against this?
So, I mean, I think I hope I made that clear in my talking points, in the sense that I think that the Europeans realize that you know, we're at the end of the line. This is the last window of opportunity to fix the transatlantic relationship. You know, it hit rock bottom with President Trump, and now's the time to improve it. So if they don't step up and, you know, honor the 2% commitment, if they don't step up and cooperate with when it comes to burden sharing and intelligence sharing, then it will be very difficult to convince politicians and convince their voters back home why we are spending, what, 70% of NATO's budget. And, you know, so I think that it is, I think that the Europeans now realize that it's not just all nostalgia and they also need to play a role. And I think they also realize that there's always going to be asymmetry when it comes to the security relationship, but that's okay. I think AKK says it herself, we need to increase or bolster European capabilities to be a strong partner for the United States.
Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
So there are a lot of questions coming in now. We have one for Matt. Matt, there is Stefan Naumann who says that he completely agrees with your analysis of a lack of strategic understanding between Germany and France, but he wonders if this disagreement could not actually be a reason for the European side to invite the United States back to the table with open arms. So what do you say, Matt?
Well, I think we'd have to see some consensus, first of all, on the European side about what to do beyond inviting the United States back to the table. The United States has been at the table. The United States accounts for 75% of NATO defense spending. It's not the United States that's at the table. It's the Europeans who are not at the table. And this is the point of what I'm saying, is that it doesn't really depend on the United States. I don't know what more the United States could do, to be honest, than it is already doing in Europe. And if you look at the allegiance that many countries in NATO have to the United States, particularly in the East, the Baltics, for example, the Poles, for example, the Czechs and so on, the Slovenes, they are much more comfortable with the United States in their camp than they are with Germany and France in their camp. And you only have to look at the video of Emmanuel Macron's recent visit to the Baltics to understand what I mean. So the issue is really an European problem, particularly between France and Germany on these issues. And unfortunately, it is becoming a problem between the United States and France and Germany as well, because despite what Suda said, yes, Germany is spending more, but it is spending nowhere near what it pledged to spend. And as Winston pointed out previously, yes, Obama raised this, but it wasn't only Obama. You can go all the way back to John Kennedy, if you want to find examples of U.S. presidents complaining about Europe being free riders. And I think that we're in a situation right now with the pandemic, with all of the pressures that Biden is going to be facing in the United States, all of the economic pressures. He's inheriting a complete train wreck. And for the European elites to think that he is going to make Europe a priority in his first months or even year in office, I think is just a delusion. Nobody in the United States is talking about these issues.
Can I give that back to Suda immediately? Because I want Suda to comment on this. So Biden is completely concentrated on the internal stuff.
In terms of the debate and a rebuttal, I guess the one point I didn't get to when I spoke was, I think Matt's whole argument is precisely why the United States needs to play a role in Europe. Yes, Europeans disagree with each other and there's constant squabbling and that's the way it is. And it'll probably be that way. But that's why the United States needs to come in and play referee in order for there to be a strong Europe. And I think in the past, you know, the Europeans had the idea that actually the White House was trying to divide Europe. And, you know, I think that there is, although Obama complained about Europeans being free riders, I think he wanted Europe to do more and take on a stronger role, because a strong Europe is in the interest of the United States because of what Matt says, because we don't have the time to play the role that we did in the post-war era. Europe needs to take on more responsibility in concert with the United States. And, you know, Joe Biden has a really experienced team. I think even though he may not have a ton of time to make visits all over Europe, although I do think he is going to make a G7 meeting a priority at the beginning of the next year simply because of economic recovery and for containing the pandemic, he's got a team that knows Europe and then can pick up where they once left off, you know, after the election in 2016.
Okay, Suda, I stay here with you. Raphael Mitaiz from the French Embassy asks, Suda, how would you qualify fixed transatlantic relations? What would that imply for the EU?
Right.
So what does that mean?
If I can take the liberty and say fixed from 4 years ago, I mean, that's the starting point that I used, because as I mentioned, I think we haven't really had an example of a president so overtly attack Europe. And I think that was definitely a shock for people here in Europe. And that's why I do think that it was a wake-up call and things might be different. My hope is that they will step up and pay more and try to have a concerted effort to reach the 2% goal.
Okay, so I give another question. That's actually a question to both of you, but I start with Matt. Matt, should Biden, with Congress, lift sanctions on Nord Stream 2 and allow the completion of the project?
No, it shouldn't lift sanctions, and it won't lift the sanctions because it's the right thing to do. It has strong support from key allies in NATO, and this is a perfect example of where Europe remains divided and why the motion stands. Biden is not going to be able to fix this. The Russians poisoned Navalny, who had to save himself by coming to Berlin. The Germans looked at it for a couple of weeks and then decided, well, actually, we're not going to do anything about this in terms of Nord Stream. You know, Nord Stream is a completely different project. There are all kinds of important companies involved there. We'll just let some grass grow on this and then we'll move on. And there's a long history of that. And, you know, you see this across all kinds of fronts, including on China, which we haven't mentioned. This is another big issue. This is going to be the main foreign policy objective of the Biden administration is to develop a coherent strategy on China. And they agree with the Trump administration, I think broadly, that China represents a serious threat to the United States, which is why they're going to be looking to the Europeans to deal with Russia mainly, and why they're not going to be rushing to re-engage with Europe. It's time for Europe to look after itself, and I think this is going to be the hard reality that the Europeans are going to have to face in the coming years.
Suda, is Biden going to let us off the hook when it comes to Nord Stream 2?
No, I agree with Matt. I think that, you know, Europeans have to take a realistic attitude towards the bipartisanship in the United States when it comes to China and Russia. There will be sanctions, and, you know, Europe has to make trade-offs, right? I mean, these are things that are going to be uncomfortable issues on the agenda, but they'll get through them. And I think that, like Akaka said, I keep channeling Akaka, you know, the transatlantic relationship should trump, you know, short-term economic interests, because for the long term, for the long haul, we want to be working together with like-minded democracies across the Atlantic. So I do think that also the German public has also come around after Navalny, after Belarus, after also the coronavirus in China, that people don't necessarily see Russia and China in the same light as they do the United States, which might have been the case in the recent past.
I have two questions on trade here from Lynn Zelle and Martin Kaczerski. And one is kind of that on the trade front, the Germans have AKK again, and we keep talking about AKK, has come up with the idea to have a new trade agreement, a new version of TTIP. And the question is there a similar debate in the United States? So would there be any appetite to make that work, to Suda?
I'm sorry, to what? Make what work?
To any appetite in the on the other side of the Atlantic for new trade agreements with the Europeans.
You know, I think the trade agreement is free trade is not a fashionable statement right now for a politician in Washington. I probably think that's the same case here. But, you know, I think that, for example, there's low-hanging fruit. The tariffs that have gone up most recently, those can be reversed in order to, you know, restart global trade flows between Europe and the United States. You know, maybe there'll be an attempt to reinvigorate TTIP, but I think that that's not going to be a priority at the beginning. As I mentioned, you know, it's important that Matt also said it. The United States is facing, you know, a triple whammy when it comes to crises, racial justice, economic crisis, and this health pandemic. So Biden's going to have his hands full, but yeah, he's going to look to Europe to restart economic recovery, but maybe not so ambitious at the beginning.
Okay, Matt, are you more positive about this? And also, Martin asked a question about the reform of the WTO, which has been kind of blocked as an institution for a very long time now. So any chance we get that going?
Yes, I think that the WTO blockade will be lifted because Biden is a multilateralist, but that doesn't mean that he's going to open the door to another TTIP-type agreement. I think that he personally would want that, but he has to deal with the reality in his own party, and the Democrats were completely blindsided by the trade issue in the 2016 election when Trump basically turned the Republicans against free trade for the first time. They've traditionally been the biggest free traders in the United States. And it's a issue that resonated in those Midwestern states that proved crucial for his victory in 2016. It has traditionally been something that the Democrats, as the American Labor Party, effectively have championed until they themselves became free traders. I think that, unfortunately, that train has left the station. And it's not just the Americans' fault. It's also the Europeans' fault. If you remember back to the end of the Obama administration, where here again, you could have gotten this thing through, and then you had the entire upheaval in Germany about the chlorine chicken and, you know, Food Watch getting into the whole thing, and all of a sudden, you know, it was dead, and here we are 4 years later, and you have AKK and other people saying, well, this would be a good idea to do. Yeah, it would be something good, but it's politically, it's not realistic at the moment.
Okay, I stay with you, Matt, because we have a question from Vladimir Handel, which I tweak a little bit because he is coming up with the China issue. And kind of China is often portrayed as kind of the glue between us, kind of together we fight against China. So why is that not an option for a renewed transatlantic relationship?
Well, because Europe doesn't have a coherent position on China, just like many other issues. You have some countries in Europe that have signed up to the U.S. or the Trump administration initiative to basically block Huawei from installing 5G into their systems. And then you have other countries, including Germany, it appears, that are playing a more kind of, you know, wait and see game. So it's not really clear how that's going to work. I think for a country like Germany, which has a very extensive trade relationship with China, the U.S. remains, despite the pressures that Sudo referred to in the trade relationship, the United States is still the single largest export market for Germany. China is also a huge export market for Germany, and they do not want to endanger that. And just as you've seen with the Russian relationship, I would argue you're going to see a similar approach to China, which is, you know, to take a, you know, very differentiated approach, as the Germans say. So they are not going to want to follow the hard example of the United States, where the U.S. is saying that they're willing to basically put their economic interests in China at risk because of the importance of stopping China influence elsewhere. And Germany and Europe are nowhere near that stage.
Thank you, Sudha. Why can China be a glue? And how could a common China strategy look like, given that decoupling is not an option for us Europeans?
Well, actually, I don't know if decoupling is really the road that Joe Biden and Congress wants to take. I was involved in a call with members of Congress and German Bundestag members, and American members of Congress actually have a very nuanced opinion of China. They don't think that decoupling is the, that's the right solution. And I think Joe Biden, you know, he wants Europe to play on his team, and he's going to want to have Europe have a common view when it comes to China. There will be red lines that he's going to set, whether it be 5G or also, you know, the sort of production of sensitive industries on the home front rather than outsourcing things to China. So I think Europe needs to make a decision. I mean, and I agree with Matt here, you know, it's a short-term economic game versus losses when it comes to intellectual property and rule of law. So these are things that Europeans need to think about while they make their decisions. And they have to get out of the framework of just seeing things through an economic lens, but also look at things geostrategically.
Sudha, a question for you from Elin Schiffer from Stockholm. Do you see a Biden administration working mainly with the EU or through NATO?
I mean, I think both. I think what's the saying? You know, I think Joe Biden hopefully can chew gum and walk at the same time and have good relations with both institutions. Naturally, you know, NATO, I think, is sort of the a priori multilateral institution. It has tradition. It has this success, even though it needs to be reformed or, you know, retrofitted for the 21st century. But I think that, you know, even if you look at Brexit as an example, I think Joe Biden will want to have a special relationship with the UK, but not at the expense of the EU.
Question for actually both of you, but I'll start with Matt. A nice one from my colleague Raphael Loss. How should Europeans prepare for the next Trumpian president in the White House?
Well, they should prepare by either deciding to pursue strategic autonomy and really doing it, which many people think is unrealistic, or they should try to rejuvenate the relationship with the United States. Because this issue that Trump has brought up over the past several years of Europe not pulling its own weight is not going to go away. He was particularly critical of Germany and of NATO in general. And I think that as, you know, more and more Americans wake up to the realities of the imbalance in this relationship, that is going to remain a political issue that the Republicans will use to really differentiate their own policies on international affairs from the Democrats. And if you think back to the example of trade, where, you know, there wasn't really a lot of disagreement in the United States on trade, and then out of nowhere, this issue of free trade and ending free trade and renegotiating all of these deals came up during the Trump administration. And I would fear that that same kind of thing is going to happen with security and with the alliances that the United States has around the world.
Thank you. Suda, should we prepare for another Trump in the White House, or was this an aberration and will never hit us again?
So, you know, I don't think that President Trump is unique to American history. We have examples of Trumpian figures like, you know, George Wallace, but they just never made it to the White House. Trump made it to the White House and he lost the election, but he did better than expected. So Trumpism is going to be a mantra for the Republican Party. And I think actually, Matt, I read Matt's article. I think that actually Germans and Europeans should make sure that they keep ties warm with the Republican Party, however hard it may be for them. It's important that they also bring Republicans along when it comes to looking for ways to cooperate and to find common ground and not just depend on Democrats always winning the White House.
Suda, I have a question because kind of strategic autonomy seems to be the hot topic nowadays and very heated debate between President Macron and AKK again. So just on the sheer topic, strategic autonomy, do you think that the Americans should embrace this or kind of should, yeah,
you know, I think
welcome the term?
Sure. We're getting caught up here with verbiage and sort of alphabet soup. I think if, you know, I would hope that Washington thinks strategic autonomy is not mutually exclusive with the transatlantic relationship. It means that Europe wants to be strong, wants to be able to make security decisions on its own when it's in their common interest, but also obviously in concert with the United States. I mean, that's what's important. That's the bottom line.
Matt, anything to add on strategic autonomy? Any thoughts?
Well, I think that a lot of people in the United States would welcome strategic autonomy. It just doesn't appear that there's a real will in Europe to pursue it. And I think that longer term, that is the real danger to the Europeans, because there's this expectation, as Suda has just articulated this evening, that the United States somehow needs Europe. Now, that is a question that I think a lot of Americans would look at and say, well, why do we need Europe? Because all of these East Coast elites are telling us that we need Europe. We've got good trading relationships with plenty of countries and regions around the world in which we do not have a major military presence. And I expect that this is going to be something that the Republicans in particular are going to keep hammering at in the coming years if the Europeans don't step up and do more to provide for their own security.
I have two questions on Brexit. One is kind of on, yeah, Boris Johnson's position now, and also the British position outside the EU and kind of the special relationship between the UK and the US. Do you see that developing?
I mean, as I mentioned before, I think that because of nostalgic reasons, you know, the United States will still have obviously call the UK as a special partner. And, you know, the UK is a member of Five Eyes. And but I also do think that Washington realized that Germany is also the de facto leader of Europe. And in order to have a strong transatlantic relationship, it's important that the European Union works and that Biden also has, or the Biden administration also has close and strong ties with European capitals outside of just London.
Matt, anything to add or should we move on?
Well, I disagree slightly. I think that the UK relationship will remain absolutely central to the United States. It has a long tradition. I don't think that it's just nostalgia. We're culturally much closer, and I expect that that will continue also because the military cooperation is so close. And this is, again, the big problem with Germany is that it just hasn't stepped up in this arena in the way that the United States has expected over the years. And it remains very controversial here. If you look at the polls in Germany, now these are pre-Trump, but even, you know, post-election, the most recent one that I saw showed that only 32% of Germans have a favorable opinion of the United States. Now, that was after the election. So, you know, I think that this is just a reality that we all have to kind of deal with and ask ourselves, well, you know, do the Europeans, do the average Germans or French or whoever they are really want the United States to remain engaged in Europe? And I'm not convinced that they do.
So you're more hopeful kind of about the strategic relationship between the UK and the US than about kind of the transatlantic relationship between continental Europe and the United States. Just that I...
Yes, because it's much more intuitive. There's a much longer history there and it's a more natural relationship. And I think will become even more natural after Brexit.
Thanks. So, Suda,
I would just like to beg to differ a little bit here. I mean, I think Matt is right for the most part in the sense that the UK has a special relationship with the United States. Also, culturally, we're very similar. We're both basket cases at the moment. But in all seriousness, you know, I think when I was working in Washington, there was also a newfound respect for Germany after the 2008 financial crisis. Members of Congress were really in awe about how Germany bounced back after that. And, you know, there's a lot of admiration for the German vocational system and just how Germany manufactures things. Now, in the security realm, that's not the case. You know, that's where, as Matt says, Germany needs to step it up in order to keep that respect and make sure that, you know, the United States has a strong transatlantic relationship.
Okay, but finally, there were two questions on the Western Balkans. So I start with Suda, because you are kind of more hopeful here. So is the United States taking a bigger interest in the Western Balkans again?
So, you know, I'm not an expert on that region. I do think that, again, going back to this, you know, the saying of a Europe whole and free, I think that the Biden administration will look to referee, will look to help, but won't put a lot of sweat equity into problems that are going on in Europe. I think that they're also going to expect Europeans to solve problems on their own, which may be difficult, as Matt says. But, you know, I think at the same time, they're not going to look to divide Europe, as has been the case these past couple of years.
Matt, anything on the Western Balkans?
Well, unfortunately, I hate to be pessimistic about everything, but this is actually a very good example of where Europe has again dropped the ball. This has been a priority for Merkel's administration, if you want to call it that, for at least 10 years. It hasn't gotten a lot of public attention, but it is something that her former foreign policy advisor, Christoph Heusgen, spent a lot of time working on. He's now the German ambassador to the UN. They've made some progress, but you know, there still are huge problems there. And I think everybody here will remember the spectacle of the former German, the former American ambassador to Germany, Rick Grenell, inviting sort of warring parties, if you will, to the White House recently. And the only reason that that happened was because Europe wasn't really able to push things forward there. And so the Trump administration used this as kind of a PR stunt to show that they could go in there and cut some kind of deal, which of course isn't really going to resolve the problems. But I do not think that the Western Balkans, where you have a lot of interference, by the way, from the country we've been talking about here, from Russia, from China, I just don't see any consensus in Europe on how really to confront that or to really make it a priority. And we just haven't seen it up to now.
So Matt, here is an opportunity to be optimistic again from Gosia Piaskowska. She asks, how do you see the Biden administration working with the EU on the rule of law and in its relations with both Poland and Hungary? So is the Biden administration concerned about the state of the rule of law in these countries and going to do something about it?
I think this is actually an issue where you could see the Biden administration become much more active than, well, I mean, the Trump administration was arguably active, but maybe not in a productive way on these questions. And, you know, that could be potentially a game changer in this dynamic if the United States shows Kaczynski in peace and Orban that they're not going to go along with this and that there are going to be consequences in their bilateral relationship with the United States if they don't kind of reverse course here. That's obviously a big ask, and I don't know how much political capital the Biden administration is going to be willing to spend on these issues. There is also a large Polish minority in the United States, of course. So this is an issue that, you know, that is important to Americans in terms of Poland in particular.
So I have one last question, and I start with Suda. I think, Suda, you agree with Matt on Poland and Hungary. If not, you have a chance to react to this. But the question is from Selina and Albrecht. Do you think that Biden stands for more representation of armed forces in the world? So do we see more military intervention again? I mean, Trump was praised for not starting a war as kind of a first president in a long time. So what can we expect with Biden?
Well, you know, I sometimes think that Europeans think that President Obama started this trend of isolationism and, you know, it was continued with Trump. But I think Americans now want more restraint, right? We're tired of these endless wars. And I'm sure every American president doesn't want to have troops and a large military footprint all over the United States. And where he can draw down troops, I think he will. But I think he also will draw down troops when it makes military sense, when it makes strategic sense, right? He'll listen to the generals, unlike what we are actually seeing right now, where there is like a mad dash to try and draw down troops from Afghanistan in direct confrontation to the officials at the Pentagon. So I think that he will, of course, look to reduce our military footprint. And the Pentagon is also talking about a different kind of strategic theater for the United States right now. So I think that will continue, but of course it will continue in a strategic way.
Okay, and one last question because we have 2 minutes. Matt, I give this to you. There was one question about Biden's coalition of democracies and the Franco-German initiative of an alliance of multilateralists. So the question is, can those two be married? Because not all multilateralists are democracies and vice versa. So do you see kind of any common ground here for the transatlantic relationship?
Sure. I mean, you know, this is not a new idea. This is something that even, you know, we've heard from Boris Johnson talking about a coalition of democracies. You can call it what you want. I think that, you know, both the liberal democracies in Western Europe in particular and the Biden administration will be very keen to kind of fly a common flag here and show that democracy has not died in darkness. The question is, you know, where does this lead in the long term? And, you know, if you look at organizations like or groupings like the G20, you really have to wonder, you know, what future that kind of format is going to have. And if you just include democracies, you know, if it doesn't include all of the larger economies in the world, you know, then you have to wonder about the influence that it's going to have in terms of really being able to pursue concrete agendas and pursue something more than just, you know, PR.
So yeah, do you want to have a last word on this? Just kind of 30
I mean,
seconds,
I pretty
something?
Much agree with Matt, and I think that something that's different about the transatlantic relationship is also that we're looking to common challenges, just not, you know, external common challenges, but also common challenges within our democracy, whether it's, you know, income inequality or racial justice, these things that are, or, you know, how my pressures with migration. I think these are things that will be important topics for this summit of democracies that Biden has planned.
Thank you. So that was the end of our Q&A session. Thank you very much, especially to those who have asked questions in the chat and for being so kind of spot on. I added some questions of my own, but overall, I think a fantastic variety of questions. So we close this Q&A session now and ask you for your final vote. So now, while everybody's voting, I'll give you the opportunity for your concluding remarks, kind of sum up your main arguments in 2 minutes, 3 at the max. Suda, first.
Sure. I mean, I think that Europeans understand that Joe Biden is the last opportunity to fix the transatlantic relationship. So I hope that there will be a change of heart on things that they used to sort of waddle over, like, for example, security spending. I hope that that will that the Trump presidency was a wake up call for them. And I think now's the time for Europe to be proactive and not sulk in terms of defeatism, that, you know, Trumpism is here to stay. I think that they need to reach out and kind of establish what they also want to get out of the transatlantic relationship. And it's also time to look beyond the traditional buckets of trade and security. Those are important. But again, as I mentioned before, how about digital transformation and climate change? There's a lot of things that appeal to like the next generation of transatlanticists that we shouldn't forget about as well. And then just getting back to Matt's point, he talked about how, what will Biden do? He'll do nothing. And I actually think Biden, again, he will encourage a strong Europe. He will encourage, sure, take it, if you want to call it European sovereignty or European strategic autonomy, whatever it is, just spend more and be a partner toward for us. And I think he and his administration will also play referee when it comes to those endless disagreements that Europeans have with each other.
Thank you, Suda, also for being right on time. Matt, shoot.
Well, I agree with Suda on one point here, which is that many people in the United States were hoping that with the change in administration, that the Europeans would see this as a final opportunity to really kind of do something about the transatlantic relationship. Unfortunately, so far, I think the signals that we've seen do not give one much hope. The conventional wisdom in Europe at the moment seems to be that, no, things will not return to the status quo ante in terms of the transatlantic relationship, which many people would argue were never particularly good to begin with. But whatever your view, things will be different now, and they won't be easy, but at least it'll be better than Trump. Well, that's setting a pretty low bar. And I think that if you want to redefine the transatlantic relationship, if you're talking about, you know, coming up with a joint approach towards Russia, coming up with a joint approach towards China, these are going to be very difficult to do if Europe itself doesn't even have a coherent position on these issues. And I'll close by quoting the strategic analyst Marcel Diussels, who recently noted that, and this is not a direct quote, but something to the effect of this, which was that America at its most divided is still more united than Europe has ever been. And that sad reality is why I think the motion must stand.
Fantastic. So now tension rises. We are nearing the end of the result. So I remind you that kind of initially we had 35% agreeing with the motion, agreeing with Matt basically, and 51% disagreeing with the motion, agreeing with Suda. And so maybe you can show us the final results now. So we have agree still 35%, disagree 56%, so disagree, so that people think that Joe Biden won't fix the transatlantic relationship. They disagree with the motion. Therefore, I would say this is a slight shift. This is 5% from don't know to disagree. So I think that I would call this a pseudo success, no?
Trump would call it a landslide.
Yeah, I told Matt, you know. What is it? Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. That's my motto.
Yeah, so 56%, previous year 51%, disagree with the motion that Joe Biden won't fix the transatlantic relationship. They think he will fix the transatlantic relationship. And so, Suda, I call you the winner of this debate. So congratulations to actually both speakers. I think you did a tremendous job and we're kind of making your causes very convincingly. So thanks, Suda. Thanks, Matt. Thanks to ECFR's Rethink team, especially to Marlene Riedel, who has done a lot to make this work. Thanks to our partners at Intelligence Squared Germany for partnering again with us and for doing kind of this first ever joint online event. This event was part of the Rethink Europe series supported by Stiftung Mercator. And I wish you all a wonderful evening and thank you very much for being with us. Also, thank you very much to the audience. I hope you don't regret it. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.